This is the Kindy Rockstars Podcast, Season 4. Bringing you incredibly talented singers, artists, creators, and producers in the genre of children's music. I'm your host, Patrick Adams. Each episode will feature songs, albums, videos, or live performances, along with great stories from the artists themselves. Kindy Rockstar Season 4 is proud to be supported and sponsored by Waltmania Public Relations, serving the family entertainment community for more than 20 years. And now, on with the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Kindy Rockstars. I am really happy to have with me today, joining me from Italy, Brian Banks, composer, producer, founder, all things of Out of the Books. And I can't wait to learn a little bit more about this. It's a fascinating band, fascinating concept. But let's learn a little bit more about you, and then we will get into doing an album feature today. So, Brian, tell us a bit about yourself and how you got into making music for kids.
Cool. Thank you so much for having me. I've been really excited to do this. I always like talking to people about what I do and why I do it. And it's always interesting to hear other people's views on why they do music, how they do music, what gets them going. And so maybe I can be some stimulus to somebody out there, and or maybe not, but we'll figure it out. But I do love being on things like this. It's really a lot of fun. Wow, how did I get here? In my early days, in my career, I was a session musician in Hollywood, in Los Angeles. And I found a very special niche in synthesizer programming. And back in those days, in the 80s, there was quite a division of labor. There were synthesizer programmers who came up with the sounds and the sequences and all the bits. And then often we would be programming these sounds for recording artists, you know, for the keyboard player to play, or producing sounds for a film composer to compose with. As things moved on, I started to compose more. But while I was doing the synthesizer programming, I got exposed to, frankly, some of the most incredible musical minds in Los Angeles. I worked with Giorgio Moroder for years, probably one of the smartest men in music I've ever met. If people who don't know who he is, he basically invented disco. He was one of the first people to ever use a drum machine. All the Donna Summer stuff. He won a couple of Oscars. He won for Midnight Express. He won Oscars for I Take My Breath Away and for Flashdance. And I mean, monster, huge brain and talent, and a very generous guy. And I learned a lot from him, worked with him for years. Also was fortunate enough to work with the likes of Quincy Jones on a big album called Thriller.
Oh, wow.
And I worked on that for several weeks, mostly programming. I did a little bit of playing, but mostly programming sounds for the album. And like I say, some playing. And then I continued to work with Quincy on various other projects, like the film The Color Purple and some of other projects like that. But, you know, Thriller was the big one. That's a whole interview all by itself.
I think so.
But you know, what an education that was. It was an education for all of us. I was working with this computer synthesizer called the Synclavier, which at the time was the bleeding edge of all digital synthesizers. And I was one of the few people in LA that knew how to use it. And I got the call for that. So I was doing a lot of that kind of work, and then also working for other film composers when I was young, doing movies like Starman and War Games and Other movies like that, again, programming sounds, playing, but doing a lot of ghost writing and ghost arranging. You know, I was starting to move up the ranks a bit, to the point where I was starting to actually score films like Internal Affairs and Young Guns, and where I actually scored those films. And using synthesizer, using live band, you know, using orchestra, whatever tools were available. I was all classically trained. I went to university, got my piece of paper. So I'm as comfortable really with a symphony orchestra as I am with a rhythm section. And that's what sort of led me to doing music and sound design for commercials. I was doing at the time in the late 80s, early 90s, I was doing music for films, television, commercials, records, theme parks, everything. I was working, doing all kinds of stuff. And I came to a bit of a crossroads in my career, and I broke up with my musical partner of 15 years, and it was like, okay, now what do I do? And I decided to do commercials. And so for the next umpty jillion years, I really focused on doing commercials. And I had some really, really spectacular, I had great luck. I hope I backed it up with what I could do, but I had some good breaks. I worked with some amazing people. I had some amazing campaigns. I had Apple computers. I wrote all their advertising music from the late 80s to the early 90s for about 8 years. I moved on from then with the same creative team. They got hired by another ad agency and went from Apple to IBM. And I moved on to do all of IBM's advertising music for 13 years. And so I did a lot of orchestral music, big band jazz music, electronica, esoteric pop, I mean, all kinds of stuff, because there are no real boundaries. And that was one of the great things, is like, I guess because I had a good musical education, you know, sometimes an education can bind you in. Sometimes an education can open your mind. And I think I was lucky. I had a really good education. And so I'm able to take apart various styles. And so I could cover styles, which made me very useful to the advertising industry, because one moment they want you to do rock. The next moment they want you to do jazz. The next moment they want a symphony. The next moment they want sound design. And I'm able to cover those styles. And so that was how I ended up sort of choosing ad music. My reputation was with all that big corporate, IBM, Apple. You know, I was doing banks and financial institutions and chemical companies and, you know, all that big, big stuff. I used to call it, I am smarter than you are music, because all these companies think they're smarter than you are. And they always have the next big idea. But my little deep, dark secret during all of this, or over 20 years of this, was that I also had a toy client. Now, toys in advertising is sort of like porno in films. It's not looked on well. And so I never talk about it. I didn't put it on my reel. It was just my little deep, dark secret. But I had this wonderful, amazing client. And all she did, almost all she did, was dolls. I had already done a 2.5 year campaign that I wrote for Barbie along the way. And when I started with this gal, her name was Margot Eldridge. We were doing all kinds of different toys. And along the way, we were doing American Girl Doll, and we were doing Ariel the Little Mermaid and all this sort of stuff. And then there was this doll line that just was about to be launched. It was called the Bratz. Now, when the Bratz released, they took a 38% chunk out of Barbie's market in the first year. I mean, it was huge. And I wrote all the Bratz music for 4 years, all their advertising music for 4 years. I mean, we did our best to jump all over Mattel and show them where it was at. We were using hip hop, R&B, kind of styles, which you didn't see in little girl toy advertising in the early 90s, early to mid 90s. Mm-hmm. You just didn't see it. It was all, you know, pretty happy, sparkly music. And the people at the toy company and Margot and myself really wanted to say, okay, well, the Bratz, they were edgy girls. They were not, you know, pretty Barbie. They were edgy, tough girls and streetwise. And so we're going to do something different. And it set the whole toy world on its ear at that point. After about 4 years, my client left that gig for her own personal reasons. And I followed her because we'd been working together already for, mm-hmm. you know, 10 or 12 years. And, not, you know, I'd go where she goes because we had nothing but fun together. About 2 weeks after she did that, she got started getting called by Mattel to start working on Barbie.
Of course.
Because Barbie was really hurting in those days. I did all that. And so she went to Barbie, and they were being handled by, and had been handled for decades, by a huge multinational advertising agency. And this one woman who operated out of her barn and in Malibu over the next year, while we were just doing little bits and pieces here and there. Actually, they basically had a showdown between her and the big agency to see who was going to get the Barbie account. And I was writing music for both sides. And both sides knew, by the way. I can shut my mouth when I have to shut my mouth. And both sides knew that I was the guy to call. And both sides knew that I would not tell on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
But Margot's creative just blew them out the water. And this one woman in her barn with four or five people that she held close to her took on this huge multinational agency, and we proceeded to do Barbie for the next 8.5 years. At which point she retired.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was over. So I had done a lot of music that I had written for children and their parents, because you can't sell a doll if the parents aren't engaged in the commercial. You know, yeah. The kid goes up, mommy, daddy, mommy, daddy, mommy, daddy, mommy, daddy, I want this. And they look at the thing and go, ugh, you know, you're done. So I'd been writing music that appealed to both. And I always felt, even then, I learned early on, and also when I became a parent, but even before, I always believed that, you know, children are nothing more than inexperienced human beings. They're not to be mollycoddled. They're not to be underestimated. You got to, I mean, you don't want to throw unheard things at them, but you need to challenge them, you need to respect them, and you need to understand that, you know, they have older brothers and sisters who are listening to pop music,
right?
You know, they don't live in a vacuum. And children's advertising music for a long time went under the impression that children live in a vacuum, and they wrote it in a certain way, and I would never do that. And so our stuff stuck out. And so I did this for like 22 years. I was selling stuff to mostly to little girls. They really didn't need. They might have wanted it. They didn't need it. You know, it's advertising. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. And I wasn't selling drugs. I wasn't selling bad stuff. But I was selling, you know, I was selling toys. Toys are things that you don't need. They're toys are things that you want. So when she was done, when she retired, my toy work basically went away with her. Because I wrote, you know, I'd done a lot of it, and, you know, it was what it was. But I thought, you know, maybe I should do something that's really good for kids. I've got these skills. I've got this experience. I love working with children. You know, when my kids were in elementary school and kindergarten and whatnot, I would go in and I would write songs and teach them songs. One day I wrote a song about the letter S, and the kids in the class, you know, they learned it. They gave it to the teachers about 2 or 3 weeks before. The kids learned it. We brought them all into my recording studio. We all recorded it together. Everybody got a CD and they got to introduce themselves on the CD. And it was just great fun. So I always loved doing stuff like that for kids. So I decided I wanted to do a music project that was for kids and their parents, always and their parents on an equal footing. You know, it's like really mostly the only really great stuff that's out there. There's starting to be some more now, but mostly it's Disney, DreamWorks, and a lot of it still doesn't do it for me. And I wanted to do something. I started this about 6-7 years ago, and I really wanted to do something that satisfied me. And I wasn't being satisfied by what I was listening to. So I said, okay, what am I going to do? And then I locked in on the concept of basing it on fairy tales. Now, fairy tales are an interesting game because everybody thinks they know them because they've seen all the Disney versions or they've read the Golden Books versions or any other versions. And today there are inside out and backwards versions where you've got, you know, where they change the story to make it somebody's empowerment story rather than what the story was, but it's sort of based on those characters with the assumption that you know the story. But for me, these stories have been around for hundreds of years. And there must be something to the stories. And I think people don't really know the stories because they've been tweaked and retold and, frankly, sanitized and commercialized to such a point that a lot of the true meanings of these stories has been lost, and the loss has entered the culture. I mean, we'll take Cinderella, for instance. Oh yeah, it's all about blonde girls getting the prince and living happily ever after. How shallow. Why would I ever want my daughter to listen to a story like that? And that is what most people are saying these days.
Mm-hmm.
If you really look at the story is about a stepchild in a horrible family situation where she's being abused and oppressed and really used almost like a slave. And she's doing everything she can do. She'll take any way out of this abusive relationship. And the prince is nothing more than a vehicle. It could have been anything. But in this case, it was the prince. It's a really clear, easy way. But she wanted out at any cost. She wanted out. And, you know, she bargained, you know, for a with the fairy godmother to just get a couple of hours. Just give me a couple of hours to show my worth and help me get out of here. And that's what Cinderella is about. Mm-hmm. It's not about getting the prince. It's not about being blonde. And you can talk about this about all sorts of stories. They all have, you know, the emperor's new clothes. Well, I mean, look at vanity. Look at the abuse of power in government all over the world right now. I mean, nothing could be more poignant than the emperor's new clothes. We had a certain president recently who was the embodiment of the emperor. And there are people all over the world who are in positions of power who abuse that power and are so vain that they don't even see themselves for what they are. And it takes an innocent eye to expose that. So these are great stories with super important messages that I didn't want to dilute. I wanted to return to the really important messages that they deliver. And so I thought, well, can I write a song that tells the story, you know, 4 or 5 minute song that tells the story from left to right without sanitizing it, without changing it, without recharacterizing it, reimagining it, the reimagining is doing it in verse and doing it as a song. Mm-hmm. And of course I have to abridge things. I mean, you can't read most songs, most stories in 4 or 5 minutes. But I thought, okay, I'm going to try it. And that's how this thing has come about.
Well, that was a lot to unpack going.
I'm sorry.
All the way back.
No, I just keep going. I'm sorry.
It is fascinating. As someone whose musical tastes developed in the 80s,
right?
Everything you mentioned, even Giorgio Moroder, I was very familiar with many of his songs that he was involved in. And then, of course, Thriller. If you didn't know of that album and your musical taste developed in the 80s, I'm not sure where you were living.
Yeah. And of course, when we were doing Thriller, we didn't know that we were doing Thriller. We were just doing Michael Jackson's next record.
Exactly. And even to the synthesizer music, like I said, I think my first couple of favorite bands were like Duran Duran. And even became a huge fan of Gary Numan. And I love that instrument.
Yeah. I love all the synth bands in the 80s. I mean, Pet Shop. I mean, it was just like, it just goes on and on and on. And that was my element. That's where I grew up.
Yep. That's just fascinating stuff. Could go down an 80s rabbit hole with you probably for hours. So I kind of see how your career evolution led you to where you are, especially with the advertising and then targeting your market towards kids and families. And I love this concept. I love, like I said, I'm familiar with all of these stories, but I'm familiar with them in learning them when I was a kid. I don't really pay attention to the movies that have come out since. You know, if my kids are watching it, they're just watching it, and it's the Disney version. It's, you know, movies like Tangled and stuff like that. But the song that, you know, goes with that story of Rapunzel, I know that's one of the songs we're going to talk about.
Sure.
I really like what you did with these, and the whole concept is just really interesting. And so we'll talk a little bit about your album. It's called Story Songs Book One, as a whole, and then we're going to feature four songs from it. But yeah, talk a little bit about how the entire album came together, why you picked the stories that you did, and then, you know, what interesting things happened pulling it all together.
Right. Well, it is only book one. I have a whole other book two really kind of ready to go. I just want to, I'm going to re-record the vocals. Like I say, this was a music concept first, and it's gone through a lot of iterations. I did the demos mostly with all the LA session singers that I work with. I would cast all the voices. Most of these songs break down that they are, there's a narrator, and then there are some step out lines from the characters. And so I would find the best big bad wolf I could find in my group of singers that I always dealt with, and find the best, you know, fairy godmother, whatever, witch. So I did them, and really fully produced the demos. They sounded like records. And I sort of went through, and I've got, like I say, really two albums worth of songs already. And I've just sort of parked it there for a moment, although there's a couple new ones in development right now, but I sort of parked it there for a while, and worked on those songs and got them out and tried to, you know, see what was going on. And along the way, and everybody was listening to these things, these are songs from a musical, man. You got to do a musical. You got to do a musical. And I thought, yeah, you know, let's do a musical. So I took six of these songs, worked with a writer named Erica M, who is a really skilled writer and really great in her own right. We got together and wrote a children's 1 hour musical play, musical theater piece called Out of the Books. And it was supposed to run at the Edinburgh Fringe in August of 2020, but there was this little germ floating about. So there was no Edinburgh Fringe in August of 2020. And as we were all in lockdown around about May of that year, when we found out that everything was getting canceled, we sort of looked at each other and said, well, what are we going to do now? And we said, well, let's shoot it and turn it into like a little YouTube thing. So we shot what was a 1 hour play script. We sort of tweaked the script just a little bit to make it a little bit more video friendly and turn it into a seven episode or seven chapter, because we are talking books, a seven chapter, roughly, like, it's a little over an hour, it's maybe 70 minutes, children's musical based on that. And that was all, that was quite a thing too, because now people are shooting on iPhones and all that kind of stuff all the time now with Instagram and everything, you know, with lockdown and TikTok and everything else that's going on. But shooting a film, okay, we were on lockdown. I was in LA with my family. But because this was supposed to have been done in England, I'd cast most of the parts with English actors, or a few of the parts, and then I had to fill them out. So we were all scattered all over the world. We couldn't be in the same place at the same time. So basically what I did is I decided to shoot this thing remotely, ran the whole thing over Zoom, sent everybody a little iPhone mic that's better than their mic on their iPhone, sent everybody a green screen, sent them their costumes, sent them their props, whatever they needed, in the post. And they rehearsed, we rehearsed, because it was going to be a little bit of a Zoom thing, you know, where everybody, you know, you'd have maybe two people on the screen, maybe you'd have nine people on the screen, just like, you know, that a bunch of frames, depending on how many characters. We always had to know where everybody was. So we had to map out where everybody was going to be on the screen. So if they're looking to speak to somebody, they're looking in the right direction. So we did this show, and it's up on YouTube right now. If you search YouTube Out of the Books and look for videos, you'll find it either as a one video contiguous, or if you look under playlists, you'll find it as seven episodes. And it was a lot of fun. Because of COVID, there was some amazing talent that was out of work. We got the likes of Carl Queensborough, who was playing the part of Hamilton in Hamilton on the West End. He was there for 4 years doing that. I had another guy, Carl Spencer, another Carl, who also had a major role in the West End production of Hamilton. So we were able to really find some great guys. We had Ryan Heenan, who had led in The Billionaire Boy. I mean, we had really super talent. There were other people that we knew. My daughter was a musical theater student, so she's in it. A couple of her colleagues were also in it because they're very skilled actors, and they were around and they were friends. And so it was a mixture. We did it, and it's up there, and I like it. I like it a lot. I mean, you know, it was done under duress, but nobody, who else was doing in you think back, August, May, really, May, June, July of 2020, everybody had their own iPhone and green screen. And we had pre-recorded their songs with them, so they had to lip sync, and all their lines had to be performed, and we had to direct them. My director was in Liverpool. My writer was in Ontario, in Ontario. I was in LA. My post-production supervisor was in New York City, and my actors were strewn all over, mostly over the UK, although I had my daughter with me in Los Angeles and another one of the actors also in Los Angeles. So we were all over the place. And so it was quite a feat to put together. Like I say, people do that much more now than they used to. But right then it was really like, really, you're going to do that? Like, yeah.
Yeah, no, that pandemic certainly ushered in a new era of creativity. And a lot of people got a lot of interesting work done during that time.
Yeah. So, you know, it's out there. And I'm very proud of what we did. Is it the perfect thing? Probably not, but I really like it. And I'm very proud of what we got done in that situation when we really didn't know, nobody knew what they were doing. So that included six of the songs from the album. And I wrote a few other little songs to kind of glue the thing together. So I had that. In that show, it's sort of like a X Factor or, America's Got Talent kind of talent show thing. So the songs were sung by one, each song was sung by one character. And each of the characters were unknown fairy tale characters. We have a big bad wolf. He's not the big bad wolf. Mm-hmm. He's a big bad wolf. We have a blue fairy. We have a frog prince. We have a witch. We have a black cat. We have, we have all the various characters, or many of the various characters covered off that you might know. But they're none of the stars. And so they were each vying for a place in the sun. In any case, that sort of gave me the structure of a band.
Yep.
And so I have a five-piece band with their manager. Now, the manager is the librarian. She's a black cat. And that's how we came up with the concept of a band called Out of the Books, because the great thing about a band is that we can, one iteration of this can be we should go off and do concerts, kids' concerts. Yep. We can do albums. So the problem was I had these demos that I'd produced with a bunch of American talent, and they were all over the place because every song I cast differently. Then I did this musical, which the songs were solo performances. So when somebody is playing different characters, it's sort of like when you're reading Harry Potter to your kid and you say, when you're Dumbledore one moment, you're Harry the next moment, you're Hermione the next moment, and you play all the parts. So that was a different way of doing that. And I really wanted to get the band sound. So I put together, mostly from the show, a band so that I resung all the songs with those voices, and re-released it as Story Songs Book One, the first 10 or 11 songs, whatever's there. And I've got another equal number sitting in my back pocket, and all I have to do is re-record the vocals and we'll be done with that. So I'm really excited about getting out book two, but that's where book one came from.
Very good. All right, well, we got four songs that we're going to feature from book one. So when I introduce the first one, you can tell a little bit of the inspiration behind it, what story inspired it. But let's kick it off with If the Shoe Fits, Wear It.
Yeah. If the Shoe Fits, Wear It is the story of Cinderella. One of the things I made sure that I did is every title is a colloquialism that adults will understand, but that also ties into the story. And If the Shoe Fits, Wear It starts off with her ugly sisters telling her, how horrible she is and how she doesn't deserve anything. And, if the shoe fits, wear it, just look at yourself. And then later on, she's starting to believe it. Well, maybe I am. Maybe if the shoe fits, I have to wear it, And then she meets the prince, and then there's the glass slipper. And if the shoe fits, wear it, brings it to a whole other place. So I did that. And that's a very special song to me because it was my first foray. That's the first one I did when I decided to do this experiment. I thought, well, I'll take the poster child for all Grimm's fairy tales. And that has to be Cinderella. You know, if you ask 100 people, at least 60 of them are going to say, what's the famous one? Cinderella. That's the one. So I picked the poster child. I wrote it and I thought, well, I'll play it for some friends. Everybody seemed to like it. So then I started doing some other ones. But again, like I said earlier, Cinderella is not about getting the prince. Cinderella is all about getting out of an abusive household and using whatever tools she has and whatever vehicle she has to get out of that situation. And that's why it's a beautiful story. And that's why it's hung around for 250 years. There's nothing magical about she gets the prince. That's easy. Getting out of an abusive relationship, that's hard.
Yep. All right. Well, let's check this song out. Here it is, If the Shoe Fits, Wear It by Out of the Books.
Just like a curse, two mean and ugly stepsisters. Her stepmother was worse. All she did was scrub and clean. Her sisters got to play, never had any fun. They worked her night and day, and they said,
if the shoe fits, wear it. Put it on, it's plain to see. If the shoe fits, wear it. Enslaved is all you'll ever be.
Then one day the prince declared
a ball to find my bride.
But Cinderella couldn't go, so she stayed at home and cried. And she said,
if the shoe fits, wear it. Put it on, it's plain to see. If the shoe fits, wear it. Enslaved is all I'll ever be. If the shoe fits, wear it. Will I ever be free? If the shoe fits, wear it. Won't someone please help me?
Then out of the blue, her animal friends and her fairy godmother appeared. They cleaned her up and made her a gown and a pumpkin coach with just one cat. She danced and danced with the handsome prince, but as the clock struck 12, she had to rush away so fast. Off her foot, her slipper fell, and the prince said,
if the shoe fits, so wear it. It's a very simple test. If the shoe fits, so wear it, and you'll be my princess.
The prince searched all the land for the foot that fit that shoe, from mountains high to sea below, to find his love so true. When he got to Cinderella's house, it fit her like a glove. His face lit up with a great big smile.
I found my old true love.
And they said,
now the shoe fits, so wear it. What a wedding there will be. Now the shoe fits, so wear it. Prince and princess, you and me. Now the shoe fits, so wear it.
They declared with glee and laughter, the prince and Cinderella. They lived happily ever after.
Happily
ever after.
Happily,
happily
ever after.
Happily, happily ever after.
And that was If the Shoe Fits, Wear It. All right, the next song we're going to talk about is called You Won't Believe Your Eyes. So tell us about this one.
Well, You Won't Believe Your Eyes is the story of the Emperor's new clothes. And I love this story because it exposes so many flaws in very, very the news of today and the news of very, very recent past. It exposes things like vanity. And all the controversy about how people present themselves on TikTok and Instagram, and how people are so obsessed with how they look and how they present themselves, and other people who are sadly driven to compare themselves to these people who are just on the camera for that moment. And the rest of the time, they look like you and me and behave like you and me, and sometimes worse. So it exposes that in terms of the emperor's obsession with having the finest clothing because he's the king. The other thing, of course, that it exposes is the abuse of power. You know, there he is, just, you know, everybody is, you know, I'm the king, you know, of course I can see these clothes, and everybody's going to do what I say, and there's going to be a parade in my honor, and I'm going to be the most fantastic thing that anybody's ever seen. And because I am the most fantastic thing that anybody's ever seen. We had a president like that. I don't want to get too political, but we just had a president like that. And when I was working on this song, you know, it was just, I mean, I could only see one face. I could only see one face when this was going on. Vanity, self-obsession, abuse of power, all wrapped up into one orange package. So this song is of the moment, and it's hundreds of years old. Yep. So, you know, that's why I like going back to the story. And so here it is.
There we go. All right. You Won't Believe Your Eyes by Out of the Books. Let's play it.
Tell a story about kings and clothes and fools, and a plot that was so obvious and just a little cruel. Years ago, an emperor obsessed by fashion trends wanted to look hip and cool, so he'd impress his friends. One day, two con men came to town, said they could weave a suit so beautiful the whole world would salute.
Mr. Emperor, the cost is on your robes. We got this new material, invisible to those who are too witless to appreciate our beautiful design. Just give us a week and you won't believe your eyes.
So the king came for a fitting without wasting any time. The tailors took their measurements, continuing their lying. When those two were finished, their hands flew in the air.
It's gonna be marvelous, stupendous, nothing can compare.
And they said,
Mr. Emperor, we're all connoisseurs. This brand new suit might cause dispute, but they'll be amateurs. Your style will be so elegant, so fresh, so cool, so right. Your kingdom will stop and stare. They won't believe their eyes.
The emperor sent his ministers to see the magic weave, but they could see nothing on the loom. Not wanting to admit what their eyes did perceive, they paid the tailors even more to show that they were fit and didn't see what they had seen. The swindlers stayed up all night, appearing hard at work. They snipped the air with scissors while exchanging evil smirks. Parade day came and it was time to try on his new suit. This haute couture deception was going like a hoot.
So, Mr. Emperor, please disrobe.
It's time to try on your new clothes.
Uneasy, couldn't see a thing. Was he unfit? It was the king. So, leg by leg and arm by arm, they dressed the emperor with charm. But there was not a single thread from his big toe to his big head. Now all of the town tonight to see the splendor
roll.
See, they were told what they're supposed to see.
What are we gonna see? What are we gonna
but
see?
But nobody told me, oh, how was I to know?
Small boy to see through all their lies. No matter what they say, we will.
right. And that was You Won't Believe Your Eyes. The next song is called Let Your Hair Down. And I can only imagine this is Rapunzel.
Good guess. Good guess. Yeah. You know, Rapunzel, it's a complicated story. It starts off with, by the way, first of all, people need to know that what Rapunzel is. Rapunzel is a type of lettuce. And it's the Rapunzel lettuce that Rapunzel's mother and father, well, mother craved while she was pregnant with Rapunzel. And the father goes over and hops the fence to steal some from the next door neighbor, who happens to be a witch. He doesn't know that yet. And so he goes over and she catches him in the act. So, you know, already we're stealing and we shouldn't be. And she says, okay, well, the punishment for that is I get your daughter when she's born, which is pretty harsh, but you know, it's pretty harsh. You shouldn't steal. So she gets, and she says, and I'll call her Rapunzel, but you can have the garden. You can have as much Rapunzel lettuce as you'd like. Enjoy. As Rapunzel grows up in the tower, the only solace she has is singing to herself. And the witch who becomes her mother figure, who has locked her in this tower, goes up to visit her on a daily basis, and she calls out, Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your hair. She lets down her long hair. She climbs up the rope of hair, tends to her, brings her food, whatever, and leaves her there. Rapunzel's really not that happy about that. And again, this is another situation where you want to get out of a situation. And the prince does come riding by, and he hears her beautiful singing, and he's just smitten by her voice. And so he repeats the call in order to maybe she'll let down her hair and he can go meet her. And he does, and they fall in love. And the witch mother finds out about this after a while. She's not too happy about it. And banishes Rapunzel to the forest. And makes the prince blind so he can never find her. So she's a really nasty piece of work. And they do find each other in the end. He, you know, over a period of years, he hears her singing and her tears of joy heal his eyes. And they live happily ever after. But it's about the consequences of stealing. And it's about, there is a lot about just the beauty of true love. And that it can really make things better when you're together. And that's what love does, you know? It's like sometimes you got to face things together. This song is a lot of fun. It's a real bopper. I really liked it. I worked with one of my co-writers, Phil Barlow. He's got a great sense about that. And he co-wrote this one with me. And we just had all kinds of fun and all kinds of laughs, but it starts off very musical theater like. It has a big broad exposition opening, and then it kicks into the tune. So see how you like it.
Yeah, no, this one gave me very Meatloaf like vibes, and I really love this song. And let's play it. Here it is, Let Your Hair Down by Out of the Books.
Once there was a lady who loved Rapunzel letters. She spied some in the yard next door. She asked her loving husband,
why don't you go and get us that vegetable that I adore?
So he hopped over the wall, which guarded all those greens. But much to his shock and surprise, the sorceress whose lettuce his planet was to glean caught him as he burglarized.
How dare you come and try to steal my lovely garden treasure? You'll pay for this, you thief, I'll show you all of my displeasure.
Oh, please take pity on my soul, I did this for my wife. She's carrying our child and I was fearing for her life.
Then I will take the child that your wife will soon deliver, and this garden can be like your own.
As she grew up, Rapunzel's hair grew very, very long. She'd sing to pass the time until the witch would come along. She'd say,
Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let your hair down. Drop it to the ground, all about. I would love to see you, Rapunzel. Listen to my voice, you don't have a choice.
a prince was near and heard a voice getting off his horse. Wondered who was that singing. He saw Rapunzel high up in a tower. All he thought was,
now, how am I gonna meet her?
Next he heard the witch begin to call. Rapunzel's head did fall from the window to the ground. Up those golden locks the witch did climb. It was a magic rhyme, and the prince could not forget. Prince waited for the time when the witch had climbed
down
her long hair. Then he thought he'd try that magic rhyme. Maybe he could climb all the way up there.
Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let your hair down. How your voice sounds, I'm astounded. I gotta meet you, Rapunzel. Listen to my call. It's such a tall wall. Just put your hair.
To get Rapunzel from that tower. Every night he'd say the magic rhyme, and the prince would climb up her hair to see her. But the witch spied them from below.
What a low blow.
She was very, very upset. She cut off all Rapunzel's hair, kicked her out of there to the forest for forever.
Rapunzel, Rapunzel, where's your hair?
Prince, he made that climb. The witch, she made him blind, so he'd never find Rapunzel. But oh, after years and years apart, trying to mend his broken heart, he heard this singing getting louder. He said,
Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let your hair down, let your voice sound, sing aloud. Can't believe I found you, Rapunzel. Turn my dark to light, come and hold me tight. You're the only one for me to love.
And they hugged.
And they hugged.
And they kissed.
And they kissed.
And he could see the girl that his love could not resist.
And that was Let Your Hair Down. All right, we're going to wrap up our song features by talking about You Can't Judge a Book by Its Cover. So tell us about this one.
Well, this is, you know, this is the big ballad on the album, and it seems to touch a lot of people. It's the story of the ugly duckling. And it speaks to discrimination of all stripes. Skin color, physical capabilities, sex, gender, everything. People being discriminated against because of fill in the blank, because of what they look like, not because of who they are. And that's the whole thing about you can't judge a book by its cover. You can't just look at a person and say, you're a this or you're a that. I know people look at me and judge me for what they think I am, and I'm looking at you, and we all look at each other. We make a first impression, but you can't stick by it. You have to know the person. And the ugly duckling is, it's just a fantastic story. He is yelled at and belittled and humiliated by people in the village, animals in the village in this case, but he's humiliated by all around him. And he searches for somebody who will understand him, somebody who will accept him. And he searches the whole his whole world. Leaves the farm where he was hatched, and he goes off into the countryside, and he meets up with all these different characters along the way, looking for somebody who just take him for what he is. And he ultimately does find a community, in this case of swans, who recognize him as a swan and show him, you're not what all these people have been. You're not this ugly, worthless thing. You're a beautiful swan. Now you can take that to the gay community. You can take that to women. You can take that to skin colors of any ethnicity that you want to take that have been pushed aside and downtrodden and squashed for generations, hundreds of years in many cases. And they need to be recognized for who they really are and not taken at a first glance and put into a pigeonhole. And when he sees himself in the pond and he realizes, my God, I don't have to listen to these people. I am who I am, and it's pretty good.
Yep. Nope. Love this message.
So the song gets big, and it's got a big ending. It gets going, and it's one of my big personal favorites, and it you know, it's won a couple of awards along the way, and I've really enjoyed putting this song out there, and it's why I wanted to do it last.
Very good. All right, well, we're going to play it now. You Can't Judge a Book by Its Cover by Out of the Books.
From the very day I hatched, I was told that I don't match. It would take an age for me to get where I am now. The other ducks, they hated me, shouted loud I was a freak. All I ever wanted was to fit into a crowd. Couldn't deal with life behind these gates. Ostracized, they made me run away. Why should I take another day? It seemed there always was somebody who didn't understand what life looked like for me. They chased me and they shamed me. Why can't they treat me like a brother? 'Cause you can't judge a book by its cover. Over the fence I found some ducks, said I could stay, but you're not one of us. They made me feel like I was beneath them, so I set out to leave. Met some ganders in the reeds. They seemed really nice to me. Said I should fly away with them to meet some girls. Before I knew that they were using me, a hunter's shot, bang, bang, oh, what a scene. So I hid till I could leave. Still out looking for somebody swimming free, still alone, not happy. I found these swans and I was drawn to them, 'cause I was so in awe. Just an ugly duckling who next to the gorgeous swans, but they surprised me and pointed at the pond. Looking down, I see a beauty that transcends. Not an ugly duckling, I have always been misread. I'm a regal swan instead. I always knew I was somebody who has so much to give but never got the chance. But when they shamed me, they made me. Now I know who I really am. Who I am. There's always gonna be somebody who understands what life is like for you. So just hold on, hold and on. Keep faith.
Keep faith.
And that was You Can't Judge a Book by Its Cover. And that wraps up our song features. The album is called Story Songs Book One. And soon to come, sounds like Story Songs Book Two. But let everybody know, where can they purchase, stream, download that album? And how can they find it and connect with you?
All the regular outlets, you know, Apple Music, Spotify, Tidal. I mean, it's all out there. Search Out of the Books, and that's OUTTA the books. It's not out of the books, sorry for my bad grammar. It's Out of the Books, and you can find it there. You can also find it on YouTube, SoundCloud. I mean, it's out there. You can find me on speak English, Brian. You can find me at outofthebooks.com. Where there's a link there to send an email, or at Brian Banks Music on Instagram is another place that I happen to be around a lot. Find me there, and also at Out of the Books Band on Instagram and Facebook. Yeah, that's where you can find me. That's where you can find the music.
Very good. All right, before we wrap, there sounds like there are several other songs. Any shout outs you want to make, any other songs you want to name check before we wrap?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want this to sound like the Academy Awards or anything, but the band, they definitely need the singers in the band definitely need acknowledgement, because they're just amazing. And they have just stepped up and made this so beautiful and so easy to work with these people. It's just been an inspiration, every one of them. Carl Queensborough, who I mentioned earlier, consummate professional and just brings so much to the party. Carl Spencer also he was hysterical to work with. He was just hysterically funny and a great, amazing talent. Sharon Rose, who was also in Hamilton on the West End, came in at the end. I recast the part that she was singing and hardly had any rehearsal time and annihilated me in the studio. Absolutely annihilated me. Ryan Heenan, who just sang what you just listened to, You Can't Judge a Book, has a soaring tenor voice and he's just a delight. My own daughter, Electra Banks, who is an aspiring musical theater singer in her own right, and she was instrumental in putting this whole thing together. She co-produced all the production of the play and of the album. She's been my right hand the whole time. And Charlie Sumter, who has just this angelic voice. I've known her since she was in, I don't know, eighth grade or seventh grade or something. And she's been a beautiful singer since then. And she's a beautiful singer now. And I couldn't wait to have her on the record. And she was amazing. My co-writers, Phil Barlow, Maudie Lowe, Els Bailey, Carla Hassett. And then there was a writing team of Steve Bailey, Ian Kellett, and Andy Nunn. They all co-wrote everything. I half wrote everything that was there or wrote it myself, but on some songs I did co-write, and they were a delight to work with. So those would be the big names. And my wife, Sarah Banks, who tolerates me and supports me and is the sounding board on my, she's my concert grand sounding board. So I couldn't do anything without her.
Well, Brian Banks, thank you so much for coming on the show. You have had an amazing and fascinating career journey. And every movie that you mentioned that you worked on, I've seen them all. Probably a good portion of people out there who grew up in that time period have seen all these. And just, I love your story. I love this concept. And I encourage everybody to go out there and check this out. Go to the YouTube channel, watch the videos for this really nice and interesting take on famous fairy tales.
Thanks.
Yep, appreciate it. Got it.
Love doing this. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.